So welcome, friends. For friends we may soon be. Friends, they're forged on that dark road, the one that's heading out of town. You know it now. We're headed there. And here we are gathered. You, perchance, before your old ones, and we, perhaps, before ours. How shall we be, then? And what shall we say, now that the call and the summons and the plea is gone out? Ah, it is better that we make as though many a thing hangs there in the rafters and hangs in the balance. As if how we are with each other, well, that is how the lords of chance will be with us. As if what we say this very evening brings in the saints, the ancients of days, or brings down the darkness and the rough gods. So welcome to this cosmic constant of ours. All our frailties, all our undoings, all our endings. Welcome to that one true glory of your life that cannot wither, cannot age, cannot fall down. Welcome to that plea from all of your unsuspected kin, trudging that lost nation road, even now. We are modern, and we are homeless, and we are confused by freedom. And so we've left them to themselves, or to each other, or to their God, as we ourselves seem now to have been left. Welcome to your one true love, the one that was wrangled from all the promises and all the betrayals and all of the octane of your younger and wilder days. All that's left is to welcome you to this catastrophe, to this old road for going down into the mystery days. A road that was braided and made by those who came before, whose longing after life made a path through the easy terrace and through that boredom without end and into life, who loved being alive as much as anyone here, and who for all of that died more or less on schedule. Who angled not for Neverland, not for ever and ever, amen, but for now, and for us, and for this.
Welcome back to the Jack's Pax Channel podcast. We are joined today by Stephen Jenkinson, the author of the award-winning book, Die Wise, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul. Stephen also makes music with his friend Gregory Hoskins and a five-piece band. Together they have made three albums, most recently the albums Rough Gods and Dark Roads. Stephen has also appeared on many speaking events, including the four-part live stream speaking series, A Generation's Worth, and an appearance on London Real. Listeners beware, it is not your usual listening experience. In his music and at his speaking events, Stephen expels the hardest of hard truths. Stephen Jenkinson, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, and thank you for the invitation too.
Morris. I've been listening to your album for the past couple of weeks, and I must say I've never heard another album like it.
Nor have I, and I'm going to take that as a compliment.
Yeah, it's wonderful, wonderful listening experience.
Thank you.
How long have you been making music with Gregory?
I think we're into our sixth year now.
6 years, wow. And was it obvious from the beginning that you'd make that sort of sound, or did it take a while to figure that out?
Oh, God, no. Nothing was obvious about it. It was the most counterintuitive thing I've done in an awful long time. Yeah. It, largely because I was, for the longest time, I was a one-person show. You know, I stood by myself and did basically, as you described, wondered aloud with no particular permission to do so many places in the world. And the thought that I would, first of all, sharing the stage in and of itself was not a problem to me, but the fact that I'd be, or the idea that I'd be locked into some kind of melodic or tempo constriction and not be able to go laterally as is my wont to do was something that filled me with dread, to be honest. And I think there was just something about his disarming persistence about that the idea had some merit, that he overwhelmed my reasonable concerns on the matter. and he's still doing that. And well, we've become very close and very dear friends since those early days. But we toured, we went on an American tour, never having played together before. Basically, our first show was in a sold-out house in New York City. I mean, that's complete madness.
Yeah,
we didn't even know what we were going to do as we walked out onto the stage quite. And we kind of found it as we went. And by the time we had done the third or fourth show, we had a sense that something had taken possession of our meeting. And it's still there, thank God.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, it definitely works for me. I think the album Rough Gods is the best one, in my opinion.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's the most recent, the studio one that we did when we were down in southern Mexico for about 10 days or 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I have a two-part question for you. What is the role of artistry in life and death, and what is the artist to society and to us all?
Sorry, what's the? Could you say the second question again?
And what is the artist to society and to us all?
Oh, to us all.
Yeah.
Well, I was asked to do an event in New York City some years ago, and I was second on the bill. And it was they called the event The Art of Dying, and the place was packed. If they had called it The Grim Friggin' Realities of Dying, there wouldn't have been anybody in the room. But it's an art of dying. So that sounds good, right? You can turn it into an art. Well, who wouldn't want that? So anyway, the place was packed and I went second. So the woman who was up before me made a kind of very winning declaration on behalf of everybody in the room. She said, you know, we're alternative now, but we're going mainstream, she said. And she lifted up her hands in victory and everybody rose and the music swelled. And it was a staggering experience, a little Orwellian, to be honest. But still, if you're a student of the times, I'm glad I didn't miss it. So then it was my turn to come up there in the wake of, you know, we're going mainstream. And first thing I wanted to say is, has anybody out there wondered what happened to the last subversive thing that went mainstream? You can't remember it as subversive, can you? No, because that's what going mainstream means. It means the subversion is gone and you're into the realm of decoration now instead. And I'm saying that to say that instead of talking about dying, I talked about art when I stood up there. I didn't know I was going to, but I was prompted by the situation. And I came up with this on the spur of the moment. I wondered what the function of an artist or art making is. What is it really? And I knew in my bones it wasn't self-expression, autobiography, and things of that kind. And for what it's worth, it strikes me then and now that art is principally a prismatic function, which means it's the art's responsibility to take the invisible culture, the culture that's not available to the culture, and through the act of art making, to make the culture discernible to itself. In other words, refract it to its constituent parts. so that the culture has some choices now that it has to make about how it proposes to proceed. And that's what the art in its midst has done to it. It's disequilibrated it. Is that a word? It's sounds, made it. Okay. I think I invented a word there. Yeah. It's made it more and more difficult for the culture to proceed more or less mindlessly. It's an enormous responsibility, and it requires that the cult of personality be ended once and for all, and that the biography of the artist gets out of the way of the art making, in a phrase. So that's, you know, I try to practice what I preach in that regard. So in the context of the Nights of Grief and Mystery show and the music that you've been referring to, it's my effort to see to it that my own proclivities and my own habits and my own preferences are not really a part of the story, and they're not genuinely. But if I have any capacity to take the temperature of the times, that's what I try to deliver on. That's what I hold myself to routinely. And you know, Gregor and I have a shared understanding that this is our social, political, spiritual responsibility.
Wow, that's cool. I like that. So do you think it's okay to separate the art from the artist then? If you've heard, say, a musician turned out to be pretty horrible person, would you still listen to their music? Or?
Yeah, and this is a very timely question, right? Not just about musicians, but comedians and lots of people in the performing arts and so on. You discover to your chagrin that they're not the person you thought they were. I mean, this is a better way to say it than they've misrepresented themselves. I mean, after all, the buying public bought the self-presentation of the artist, and that's one of the reasons the money comes in, right? And if you turn out to be disappointed or that you were a bad judge of character, first of all, that's on you. And second of all, I don't know that it demeans the consequence of the art or the music in this case, among you. You may not be obliged or you may not be thrilled at the prospect of this discredited artist marrying one of your kids, let's just say, or being close to you in any way. Yeah. But maybe their work is not them.
Yeah.
The cult of personality makes it impossible to distinguish the two. And that's why these people are being disappeared on a routine basis now. What's canceled, I think, is the technical canceled, term these days. Yeah. But that's why.
Yeah.
It's because it's, you know, the cancel culture is a child of its time. It's not a fit of sanity in the midst of a crazy time. The cancel culture is part of the craziness. And because it derives from the insistence that you're buying the artist as a human being. You're buying their heart and their soul. And it's yours now. And it's yours to be comforted by. And they have no business being human and frail and flawed. It's an obscene expectation to have of the person you married, never mind a person you bought a record from.
Yeah. In your books and music, you speak of the trouble we face in this modern world where most of us feel there are no elders to help guide us through life and death. Why do we find ourselves in this situation?
Well, it's kind of a two-part question, I think, or answer. Why are there no elders, and why do we find ourselves in this situation, which is a slightly different consideration? So I'll start with the first one. I was just talking about this last night here. Elderhood is not the inevitable consequence of being older, any more than wisdom is the inevitable consequence of having a lot of life experiences. If that were true, if that was the sort of demographic and spiritual math of the situation, then in my corner of the world, and probably yours too, we'd be awash in human wisdom. We wouldn't know what to do with it all. We'd have so much of it because we have an aging population. But we're discovering, are we not, or have already discovered, that an aging population does not bring wisdom to the doorstep. That's simply not what happens. It brings as much carnage and debris and trauma as it brings anything else. So something happened. I don't think you're going back thousands of years here, but something happened on the road from middle age to aged that made elderhood AWOL, made it more or less disappear. And I suspect this is what it is. When you begin to corrupt people's ability to be limited and frail, and finally to end, if you compromise their frailties, if you maximize their potential, if you insist on everybody being all they can be, to exhaust every possibility that was there before them, be not surprised that they come to the ending of their lives complaining, belligerent, hostile, aggrieved, traumatized, and the rest, because the end of their life doesn't resemble the victory march of the preceding part of their life. No. So it seems to me that elders are made principally the way wine is made. Here's the parallel or the analogy. I don't understand wine, but when it's good, I know that it's good and I like it. But I've inquired about it a little bit, and they tell me that this is how it works. You start off the winemaking process with, let's say, 100 gallons in this oak barrel of grape juice. Nobody's idea of a good time. Grape juice, that is.
Yeah.
And so let's say 5 years goes by, and let's say the decision is made to bottle it now. Do you still have 100 gallons? If it's good wine, it's almost certain that you have less than 100 gallons. Where did it go? Where did the balance go to? The answer is, that's the price for having aged, that the wine is less wine, but it's wine now all the way through. And that could be said of humans. There's less to you now, but you're utterly that now, finally. And that's what aging does to you if you're smart. So we don't believe in aging, it doesn't seem to me. In the West, we believe in victory. And of course, youth, it goes without saying. So this is goes a long way towards accounting for the fact that when, I don't know how old you are, but I gather by the sound of your voice that you're quite a bit younger than me, probably. And you know, people your age strike me, people in their 20s and 30s in particular strike me as amongst the loneliest people on the planet. In fact, their loneliness rivals the loneliness of old people for almost the same reason, that you've been obliged to live your whole life with the absence of a bona fide example of what paying the price of aging more gracefully actually looks like, it feels like, to be beside as a living example that you could emulate when your time comes. In other words, you've kind of been abandoned as older people have pursued basically the same set of values and priorities perhaps that you have. So you put those two sets of answers together, you begin to get some understanding of my take on what's happened during the course of my own lifetime.
Yeah. We've been sold the idea, perhaps by Hollywood or perhaps by superficial logic, that hope is virtuous. What's your take on that, on hope?
On hope?
Yeah.
This is easy, sadly. Hope. Okay, I'll begin with this observation. You're sitting wherever you are. I'm sitting here. We're having a conversation, although I'm doing obviously most of the talking, but we are going back and forth to some degree. And the only thing that I can think of that's not required for us to be able to do so is us hoping that we're doing so. I'm sitting in the chair. I don't need to hope I'm sitting in the chair. You're doing the same. You don't need the hope. In other words, if you're fully engaged in the present circumstances of your life and this world, hope at the very least is an encumbrance and far from necessary. But at worst, this is what it does, it seems to me. As you may know, I worked with dying people for quite a long time, and it was with them that I learned the following. they were obliged constantly to be hopeful. They were dying, and the people around them, including the people who were paid to be there, obliged them to be hopeful or positive, which is code for hopeful. Now, I used to ask, what are these people supposed to be hopeful for? And they said, that's not the point. The point is, in a general way, to be hopeful. I said, no, that's not how hope works. Hope has a goal, and it's always in the future. So it's a tyrant, hope is, masquerading as your best friend. And its tyranny goes something like this. You have to have a future to make the present worthwhile. You have to have something to look forward to be able to go forward. You need the future to make the troubles of the present worth going through. In other words, this has to be temporary, but the future, that has to be permanent. Wow. When does the future ever happen? Yeah. Answer is, it doesn't happen. When the future finally happens, that's called the present. The future never takes place. It's an absolutely ludicrous goal to hope that you continue, because you are continuing. And this is what you're doing with your continuance, hoping you get some more. My God, where does it end? When do you finally have enough of what you're hoping for? And the answer is, hope doesn't allow you to have enough. It doesn't believe in sufficiency. It believes in a kind of twist on abundance. The more possibilities, the better the present becomes, kind of thing. So you can tell I'm hard on hope, and I consider it one of our lesser considered four-letter words. And there's a reason that it rhymes with hope, excuse me, with cope and with dope. Because those three, they're kind of the holy trinity of modernism, I think.
Wow, that's a whole new way of putting it. I like that. I'm curious if you can expand on what I found to be one of the most powerful lines I heard in your music. That was, if I'm quoting correctly, "The people of today can't tell the difference between being useful in troubled times and being used by the troubles of the time."
Yeah. He delivered it pretty well too. You were listening.
Thanks.
Yeah. I love that story. I love the music that the band came up with. I love that performance of it, to be honest. And I love that line. Yeah. It was something that occurred to me late in the development of the story. It actually came from Gregory's music. We followed that with a song called Shadow, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the actual quote is not people. The actual quote was, young people now can't tell the difference between being useful in a troubled time and being used by the troubles of the times. I'd like to suggest, and I do so very sadly, that the entire sort of social justice machinery is using young people. And it's a wretched thing to watch, as young people are sort of ground into a kind of homogeneity, a kind of sameness that not only takes away their edges, but takes away any capacity to properly occupy the particulars of their time and place, and turns them into the latest, greatest globalized consumer group. What they're consuming now is grievance. And anybody who's my age who's contributing to that has a lot to answer for, I think.
Okay. A bit from your book, Die Wise. He didn't mind dying, but he didn't want to be there when it happened. So right. Would you say, is most people's idea of being okay with dying really an okay with disappearing?
Well, I have to guess, because I'm not one of the people you're referring to. I don't see it that way, at least not from where I'm sitting now. But from what I saw, it seemed to me that most people came to their dying time dumbfounded that they were in their dying time. In other words, this is probably the most foreseeable thing in your life, beyond what kind of a person you are or what you think your proclivities are. the fact that you'll die someday is one of the few things you can count on that you can't screw up too badly. And for all of that, they came to their dying time astounded that this had befallen them, as if they had to have done something, you know, pretty acutely wrong to prompt such an event. The alternative being, of course, that things would have gone swimmingly otherwise if they had been better people or eaten less hamburgers or worried less or whatever they think the cause is. Now, the cause of dying is, of course, is being conceived. That's the cause of death. Cause of death is you breathe more than one inhale. So there it is. And you're not alone. You'll die on your own. That's true. But you will die not lonely if you're willing to learn how much of your dying you share with other people. And then finally, you know, the notion that you disappear is kind of bravado, isn't it? It's like the lame ass part of the hero's journey, it seems to me. That the truth of the matter is that the meaning of your life, in other words, its continuance beyond you, is not in your hands. Do all the interviews you want to do, write all the books you want to write, stand in front of as many audiences as you can possibly manage, and it's still not up to you how you'll be remembered or if you'll be remembered. It's up to everybody else, everybody who survives your death. The meaning of your life is in other people's hands. Now, a lot of North Americans panic at the thought, until you realize the other half, the meaning of other people's lives, well, they're in your hands. Let us proceed as if the presence of another person is a kind of unexpected, precious thing in your pocket that you never sought, you never looked for, but you have all kinds of evidence that your willingness to see another person is the occasion by which they find out that they're still here.
Thanks for that.
You're welcome.
Well, I know we have an out coming soon, so thank you for coming on the podcast today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Beautiful. Well, you've given me a lot of food for thought, so I'll be... me and my listeners will be thinking about that stuff for a long time, I think.
Happy chewing.
Awesome. Have you got a tour coming up that you can let listeners know about?
Man, if I knew the answer to that question, I wouldn't probably be doing interviews because I'd be so rich I couldn't stand it. because I would know what's going to happen. And I'm like everybody else. I have no idea when the all clear whistle will blow. And even if it does blow, I don't know if people are going to be willing to congregate. I honestly am not sure about that. So I'm beyond having any insistence about it, you know. But quietly, I'm readying myself for the real possibility that people in their 10s and 20s might be willing to come together for something called a night of grief and mystery that promises nothing but grief and mystery. And if there was ever a time in recent human history that could use such a night, the post-plague time will be one of those.
Awesome. All right, we're going to play this episode out to your track from the Rough Roads album titled Regrets.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you. Links are in the description for those who want to listen to the three full albums at bandcamp.com or to visit your store at orphanwisdom.com. Stephen Jenkinson, thank you again for coming on the podcast and sharing your music and your wisdom with us.
Thank you, sir. It was a pleasure and it was a privilege to be asked.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Well, with all of this, of course there are regrets. Of course there are regrets. down along the fence line, in the back 40 of your life, there's a pile of stones there. And you know what they are. Those are your regrets. And if you don't go down there, and if you don't visit them often, you're going to end up thinking that there's no pile there at all. And that's never true. Or you can end up deciding that it makes a pile a mile high, which is almost never true. So here it is. They're always there. And the pile is rarely as high as you think it is. So how about this? When the ending of days comes into view, maybe that's a good time to go down there and visit that little altar. Because that's what it becomes now. An altar where you can pray. Here's an idea. Don't add another stone to the pile by how you are with the ending of days. Just remember. And then climb that little hill, picking up one stone at a time, and then putting it down. Remembering. It's not all bad. And when you get to the top, look around now. Because that's the vast field and pasture of your life. And everything in it is now visible and lucid and clear. And you can only really see it from up there. And that's the big story.